תגור אינונה ברשותת אדור קושו ניגים יחדית אינונה ראשבית קימן נורפת ביער הרפוצי גרים מקונק נניה
Hello and welcome to Ocean Research Project. I am Matt Rutherford, captain of the Alt, and we are in West Greenland. Ocean Research Project is science, education, and exploration, and I am probably doing this show from one of the strangest places I have ever done the show and maybe ever will do the show. I am on the bridge deck of a sunken ship. Well, more appropriately, a half-sunken ship. The boat is, of course, on its side. It's heeling way over. I'm sitting in the captain's seat, which is pretty funky, but it's holding me in place. It's low tide right now, so a bit more of the boat is showing out of the water. At high tide, about two-thirds of the bridge deck is actually underwater. That this captain's chair, the one I'm sitting in, remains out of the water at all times. Sort of a funny story, I guess. The fishing company who owned the boat went out of business. The government sort of foreclosed, took the boat. The boatyard here in Asiat, where I'm at, decided we don't want this thing in our boatyard, so they parked it out at the end of, well, it's not really a dock. It's more like a series of rusty barges. And they just didn't tend to it, and it sunk. And it's a 80, 90 foot long wooden 200, 300 ton fishing boat, and it just sunk way out here. And so we came into the harbor, and the seawall in Asiat is, I don't know, somewhat busy. We were in Asiat last year for a few days, and it's one of these seawalls. There's only one seawall for the town. There's a lot of fishing boats that come and go. Of course, they get priority because they're work boats. They're out here trying to make a living. And when you're just sort of a visiting yacht, you know, none of these ports in Greenland have a place for visiting yachts. There are no marinas, and most of the space on the seawalls is already taken up by the locals who are doing work, who are doing jobs. So last year I had to move around quite a bit. You know, at one point I had a fishing boat last year at like 3 in the morning come up right next to my boat. I was tied off to the seawall and start honking its horn, and I'm, you know, running out there in my socks, and maybe like a foot and a half from my boat is the bow of this massive, you know, 80-foot, gnarly, old wooden fishing boat with like 3 spotlights, all of them right on me. And, you know, some Greenlandic guy standing on deck sort of just looking at me. And, you know, they're telling me, you need to get out of my spot, basically. And, you know, it's 3 in the morning. And where are you going to go? So, you know, jumping around on seawalls is fairly normal in Greenland, especially in the larger towns. I think this town probably has 1,000 people, maybe 2,000 people. So I guess technically it's a larger town. And so this year I didn't want to deal with that, and I also had to do some work on my engine, and that means I had to weld some brackets that broke that hold the alternator onto the engine. For the last, I don't know, maybe 80 days or 75 days, maybe longer, my alternator has been connected to my engine with 2 out of 3 of the brackets broken. And the only thing that's kept the alternator belt tight is a block of wood that I pounded with a sledgehammer between the alternator and the engine block itself. So it's really been holding on by a very thin margin. I mean, if there's one other end of the bracket were to have broken, I would have no way to keep the alternator tight. And you know, but I didn't really have many options. I was up by Connacht, and there's not like there's any real mechanics up there. There were no welders up there. You know, you're in a high Arctic. There really was nothing going on up there. So, anyways, it wasn't that big of a deal, but I knew I was going to be stationary, so I tied off to this sunken ship. I actually came here to haul the boat out. That was the original plan, but they wanted $2,500 to haul the boat out for 3 days, which is insane. But they let me tie off to this fishing boat, and I saw that this, you know, we needed a good spotlight. Earlier in the episode, I talked about how I got a light off of a snowmobile and some old busted up vehicles at the Conock trash dump, trying to make a spotlight, but it didn't see very far. Well, this sunken ship, you know, like I say, it's half sunken, and there is a spotlight. So I went up and I asked the owner, you know, hey, what you want for that spotlight? And he gave me a good deal, and so I got the spotlight off the sunken boat, and now I'm hanging out in the bridge deck at a pretty good heel, maybe 45 degree heel, maybe more. But I needed to get away from the boat where our engine is running right now on our boat. We are charging up batteries because we're going to leave tomorrow to cross the Labrador. And Nicole is getting some stuff ready, and I needed somewhere quiet. And since we're tied off to this sunken boat, I figured might as well do the radio show on board. But we left Upernavik, talked last time about all the craziness that happened with the storms, and the one storm in particular, and the Danish Navy giving us a tow about 15 miles or 12 miles or whatever it was, and having to cut some lines off the prop, and my crew was very shaken up by this. And I had to do quite a bit of reassuring them that, you know, everything will be okay, everything's fine. The boat didn't have any damage, and nobody got injured. It's really the spirits that got injured in that situation. Their spirits were more injured than the boat or anything else, because they were just rattled. And I don't blame them necessarily. You know, it's a situation that could rattle a lot of people. But the injector pump broke, and I mentioned it kind of briefly at the end of the episode that and that was sort of hectic. But luckily, I was able to fix that. And the engine's been running great ever since. And, you know, it's, you know, old Perkins 4108. Once you get them up and running, they're very reliable engines. So we get down Baffin Bay without much of a problem, get to Upernavik. There's no chain. There's no real normal anchors I can buy. I lost my primary anchor and chain, so I'm trying to find something. And I have some spare chain on the boat, but it's not terribly long. And maybe 50 feet of 3/8 chain. And I have a Bruce, you know, this 45-pound Bruce claw. But what I did find is these grapple anchors. So I have three of these 30-pound grappling anchors. Maybe they're about 35 pounds, really. And you see them on dinghies. They're like the little anchors, normally, that they fold all up. And then you can take this collar, this metal collar, up, and I think it's four different grapples, kind of like spikes fall down. And so anyways, it's worked well coming down. I make a system where when we anchored, depending on the wind, I would add more of these grapples. And if I thought it was going to blow hard, and it hasn't really blown anywhere nearly as hard as it did up north, then I would deploy all three every 15 feet, roughly. I'd put another one of these 30 to 35 pound grappling anchors. And because they have four of them, two of them are always in the water. Two of them are always in the dirt. And it holds like crazy. It's, you drop that rig and almost instantly you're grabbing the ground. But I will say, I really wish I thought of this ahead of time. I never heard of anybody doing this sort of a system, and I didn't even know you could get these large folding grapple anchors in Greenland until I looked in this little tiny shop in Upernavik. But this probably would have saved us a lot of trouble, and it's not a bad idea for those who might be sailing off to places where you might have to anchor in strong winds. You can add these giant, well, they're not that giant. You know, they fold up into maybe a 2-foot-long package. But when you unfold them, you know, they have a pretty good circumference. And you can put these on your chain as additional weight and as an additional thing to grab the bottom, and it will really help. Now, it is a slow, there's the positives and negatives. The positives are that this system will really help you hold. And it's extra things that can catch on rocks or whatever. It's a good way for an emergency, like a storm situation, to improve your anchoring system. But the negatives are, first off, it takes longer to deploy your anchor and bring your anchor up, because you got to add these grapples to it, and you got to unfold them on the way back up. You got to fold them up. You cannot sit on this system for very long, because if you are in an anchorage through several, for let's say 5 days, and it has a tide, and a tide goes one way, then a tide goes the other way, you run the risk of your line and your chain wrapping around the grapples. So this system would only work temporarily, just during that blow. So if you know it's going to blow a gale, and it's going to blow for 12 hours or 20 hours or 6 hours or whatever it's going to do, this is a system that you can add something like these giant grapples, or there's probably other anchors similar to it that will help to hold the rig. And the nice thing about these is they fold up. Now, one other thing is it's more weight on your windlass, so you have to think about that also. But so I got this system, and it worked well coming down. And it's dark now. You know, it's dark in Greenland. It gets dark at night, I should say. It's not dark right this moment. It's maybe 5:30 in the afternoon. But you know, that changes everything. That's why I bought the spotlight off this sunken ship, is because, you know, there's ice, and you have to be able to see the ice. The ice does not have AIS. Some of the ice you'll see on the radar, you know, the bigger pieces of ice, but the pieces of ice that are really a concern are pieces that are around the size of a container. And a lot of that ice is going to be underwater, and you might not see that, especially if you're sailing along in any kind of wind, any kind of conditions. Chances are you're probably not going to see it. So it changes the whole dynamic. It changes everything about how you can operate in the Arctic. When you have 24-hour daylight, it's a whole different world up here than when you have nighttime. It makes you basically do day jumps. You get up with the sun, you go through the day the best you can, and then when the sun sets, you need to be somewhere on anchor before that happens. And typically, you're dropping anchor right around the time the sun is setting. You know, I don't know if you guys can hear that. There's like a whole bunch of water pouring out of something below me. Yeah, the tide is very low right now. It's an especially low tide. But I think the tide is just starting to come up. And so I think the hold underneath of me is starting to fill full of water. And that's why I hear that that water rushing in below me. But anyways, it's time to go too. When it gets colder, when it gets darker, it gets colder. So that's a whole nother element. Where we were doing research, our main project with NASA, there's 3 feet of snow there right now. I just found out yesterday, 3 feet of snow. And we were just up there recently, like a couple of weeks ago. There wasn't any snow. It snowed where we are yesterday. So, you know, it's getting time. There really isn't a fall season in the Arctic. It's sort of like, if you've ever been to a hot climate, you don't really have like a spring and a fall. You have a dry season and a wet season. It's sort of like that in the Arctic, where it's not as much you have a dry season and a wet season, but you don't really have a spring and you don't really have a fall. It kind of goes from summer to winter very quickly. And, of course, the winter is much longer than the summer. Most of the trip down here for a good couple of weeks, we had every single day we had gray skies and we had light rain every day, all day long. And our engine heater broke. So that sucks. I mean, our engine heater is great. You can, I think I might have talked about this in an earlier episode, but if not, you can buy one. I buy it off of Summit Racing, which is they make parts for cars. And it's just a car heater. And you connect it to the coolant coming out of your engine, and when the coolant heats up, it heats this thing up, and all it is a fan. It's no different than what you have in your car. When the engine on your car heats up, you can pull heat from it. It's the same exact thing. So whenever you run your engine, you can heat your boat, and it's great, great thing to have, and it dries your boat. Even more importantly, the heat helps to keep things dry. And that's an important thing to remember, especially in these sort of climates. It isn't just about being warm, it's also about being dry. So anyways, the engine heater just broke. I mean, I ran it for probably 2,500 hours. I've got some use out of it, but it just eventually died. And I had this new crew member, I'll talk about that in a minute, bring me another one from the States. So we replaced it. They're only like $175. They're not very expensive. As far as, everything on a boat. Boat is an acronym for break out another thousand. It's everything on a boat seems like it costs $1,000. So as far as boat stuff goes, it's pretty cheap. But it's just been gray. There's ice on the dinghy every morning. There's ice on the decks. If you want to row to shore in the morning, you got to scrape the ice off the dinghy. If it rains, you can get a decent amount of ice on your boat at night when it all freezes. So it's getting down below freezing. It snowed yesterday. It's really time to go. And all this weather has changed just in a couple of weeks. All this is changing. Last year, we hauled out October 1st. And last year, on October 1st, it was 20 degrees, which is, I don't know, what is that, like -5 or 6 Celsius? So 20 degrees, man, that's cold. There was snow everywhere. That was 100 miles south of here. And all the water in the harbor was freezing, and all of our heaters were broken. And it was just silly, really. I mean, but anyways, I got to cut to a commercial break, and I'll be back.
Hi, I'm Sarah O'Kelly, founder of Skipper's Review. I started Skipper's Review because I wanted somewhere online for my local boating community to make connections and recommendations. So now it's up and running. I've been getting out of the office to enjoy the Florida sunshine and to meet some of my members. Each week, you can hear me swapping salty tales with sailors, surfers, swimmers, divers, boat owners, and builders, anyone with a story to tell about their life and their relationship with the sea. So join me, Sarah O'Kelly, with Skipper's Review on Boat Radio.
Hello, and welcome back to Ocean Research Project. I am Matt Rutherford in Assiut, Greenland, sitting on the bridge deck of a sunken ship, which is heeled over a good 45 degrees. I'm sitting in the captain's seat, and it's a funky, ripped-out boat. There's a computer laying on the ground next to me. A lot of the electronics are pretty old on this boat, although there's some good stuff on here. There's a compass that's maybe a foot and a half from my feet. My feet are propped up. Boat is so heeled over. This compass is probably worth $500-$600. It's an incredibly nice compass. There's all sorts of nice gauges and wires, and there's good stuff on this boat. But I don't know. I really like the Greenlandic people, and there's a lot of nice people and a lot of friendly people, and it's like anywhere in the world though. I mean, you have good and bad people everywhere in every country and every culture, but they can be a bit wasteful in the sense that there's, if you go to the dump, for instance, you can find all sorts of great stuff just laying around in the trash dump. And we go dumpster diving at the dump, and we find all sorts of good stuff for the boat. And here's a boat that's been sunken. This boat was here when we were here last year. and there's just, I don't know, there's at least a few $1,000s. Well, probably more than that. I bet you there's 10 grand worth of salvageable stuff on this boat that would be easy within a couple of weeks. You could get it off. One person, could salvage this boat and get a good 10 grand worth of stuff. But anywho, sitting here in Greenland, we're getting ready to go. The trip down, like I said, was hopping at nights, going through the day, anchoring at night, changes the whole pace of everything. changes the watch system. Does make life a lot easier. We're doing like 2.5 hour watches with 7.5 hours off. I mean, that's a pretty mellow watch system. We did go through the night, one night, crossing the mouth of Umanak. Umanak is a town. I just refer to Umanak as an entire region, just as I refer to Kanak as an entire region. But Umanak is really a town in a region, and it's in this fjord. It's almost like a fjord complex. Like, you go into the mouth of this area, the mouth is maybe 50 miles wide, and then inside of this area, sort of like a large bay, is tons of fjords, tons of little fjords with glaciers at the ends of them, big mountains, lots of ice. Umanak is a notoriously beautiful region. We just sailed past the mouth of it. We didn't go in because we didn't have any research to do there. We only go where the research takes us. But there was going to be headwinds, and I didn't want to battle with the headwinds, and it was still, I guess, early enough in the season, so to speak, early enough in the changing of the season, that there was a wee bit of light, you know, just dusk, just a wee bit of light. And so I said, all right, to hell with it. Let's just go through the night. We're going to have calm conditions. I tried to use the spotlight that we had from this snowmobile, and it sort of worked. I mean, it worked out like 50 feet. But, you know, the conditions were calm enough. And so we're going through the night, and there is some ice definitely coming out of the mouth of Umanak. Mostly big bergs that you spot on the radar, but there are occasional pieces that can pose, smaller pieces that would be harder to see. And we did dodge a couple of them. But I also slowed the boat way down. So we were only going about 2 knots. In the period of night where it was truly dark, where it really got hard to see, which only lasted a few hours, we slowed the boat down to idle and just kind of crept along with the engine in idle and made it a lot easier to dodge. Unfortunately, Dana, my mate, wanted to get a weather report. I don't know why. You know, I never asked him to get a weather report. I was on watch with him. I was up the entire night. I just did, you know, everybody else did watches. I just stayed awake all night making sure, you know, we weren't hitting any ice. But anyways, he was standing there, and there was some wave action was starting to pick up, and the boat was getting thrown around a bit. And he opens up our work computer, and a wave hits. He loses balance, and he spills an entire cup of tea all over our work computer. It's a Panasonic Toughbook, and granted, it's a Toughbook, right? You think you could spill some water on it, or some tea on it, but you can't dump an entire glass of tea right on top of the keyboard. And he did this and fried the computer. And I told him I just got a weather forecast. I mean, I was telling him not to do it as he was doing it, but anyways, it really sucks because that not just is it a brand new Panasonic Toughbook, but that had our entire project from all this research we did up north on it. And we backed up all the files, but it's not like you can just load the raw files into the HiPack software, it's the GIS software, and expect it all just to work like it would have worked before. There's a certain amount of memory that is going to get lost. I mean, it's not raw data files, but various sort of waypoints and just marks that we made and little reminders and things that aren't just going to load up easily. So unfortunately, this makes Nicole's job of processing this, you know, 6 weeks of nonstop research that we did, or as close to nonstop as we could, it's going to make it a lot harder and a lot more difficult. So it's, I don't know, he says he's going to replace it, he'll pay to get it fixed, well, hopefully he does, but it's a kind of a shame because it's our work computer. I don't know, it's sort of like lessons learned, you know, we try to be nice and we try to be open and, you know, we try to share our stuff. You know, I try to share my iPod, and, you know, he broke that. He didn't mean to. It was on accident. He just left it laying around, and it flew across the boat in one of the storms, and it got wet, and it broke. But, you know, it wasn't supposed to be laying around. It had a home in a drawer, you know, and you just... The problem is, you know, there's some people that if you give them an inch, they'll take a mile. And that's just the sort of person he was. You know, he told him that, yeah, you can send emails on a work computer, you know, from time to time. I didn't know he'd be sending, you know, started off just sending a couple, but next thing you know, he's sending 5-6 emails out every day or something. You know, it's just, and then people get familiar with your stuff and they start using your stuff more and more. And, you know, and there's a bunch of other stuff that, you know, there's a book, a really nice $200 book that he also let just lay around. You know, at first we said put all the books back on the bookshelf. And I don't know, I ain't trying to go on and complain too much about the situation, but it's just a lesson learned. You got to be careful when you have crew. You really got to be, unfortunately, stricter than I like to be. You know, you can't just share your stuff. Whatever you share with your crew, you can just assume that they're going to break it, or that they might break it. And if it's something that's mission critical, like our work computer, I mean, this is our science computer. This is the computer we've been using to do the research and store files. I mean, we backed up our files, but still, this thing was basically mission critical. And now it's broke because somebody just got too familiar using it and, you know, wanted to get a weather forecast at 3 in the morning while we're dodging ice at night with some wave action. And, you know, even though I told him that it was unnecessary and I had just done it, you know, he just didn't listen. He didn't listen much to me anyways. It's just sort of the personality. A lot of different personalities, lots of different people, you know, with different personalities. It's just the way it is. And so, yeah, that really sucked. But anyways, we carried on past that, and we had to go back and pick up the pressure sensors. Earlier on, I did a show from what I called Arrowhead Island. I don't know how to pronounce the name of this island. It's one of the most difficult, crazy jumbles of letters I've ever seen. So anyways, Arrowhead is much easier. And this is the project we were doing with scientist Dr. Clark Richards, who is working with Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute. And we were deploying these sensors because the pressure sensors can, theoretically, count the calving activity of the glaciers. And it's a little more than theoretically, to be honest. I mean, we looked at the data after we picked up the calving sensors, and we could see some pretty big calves. I mean, we're talking, you know, 25-foot waves that were produced by some of these calving activities. And that's some pretty scary stuff to think about. I mean, you got these really rocky shoreline, and you're trying to deploy these calving sensors, and some of them we could deploy by foot. We'd go on this, you know, we went on this long hike to over this mountain on this island to deploy half the sensors, and the other half we deployed with a dinghy. But if you were sitting there rowing up to one of these locations that you want to deploy this, you know, in your dinghy, and a 25-foot wave comes along, it would kill you. It would pick your dinghy up and smash you right up against the rocks. We saw a smaller calving wave come when we were going to pick up one of the sensors, and basically all the water sucked away from the region, sort of like a tsunami. All of the water sucked away, and just a few seconds later, this big wall of water comes rushing in, slams up against the coastline, a giant, you know, wave, you know, spray everywhere. You know, if a dinghy was in that path of that, you'd be dead. It's sort of, we didn't see anything like that when we were deploying them, you know. It's sort of like a sobering thought, like, oh, crap, you know. Now, we were very careful also to watch the glacier face. We were watching for calving activity. We were watching for waves in the water. These giant waves, 25-foot crashing waves that I'm talking about, you wouldn't even notice them in the deeper water. And most of the fjord is deeper water. The way that this sort of thing works, and it's just like the big tsunami that happened around Christmas some years back. I think it was, 15 years ago or something. Maybe it wasn't that. It was a long time ago. I think 200,000 people died. A lot of it in Thailand, Sumatra. Anyways, the fishermen, Sumatra, for instance, the fishermen who went out to fish that day, they didn't even notice the tsunami because they were in deep water. It just went right underneath of them. But they went back home at the end of the day, and their entire village was wiped off the face of the earth with every single person they know basically being dead. I mean, that's had to be just an absolutely insane experience. But this is a similar situation, just in the extent that the waves don't get big until you get close to shore. And since it shoals up so quickly, it would be hard to detect. What might look like a 3-foot wave, in 1,000 feet of water, not very far from shore, could turn into a big 25-footer real quickly. Now, we didn't have any funding for any of the tackle to deploy this equipment. I do think we should have all metal rig. You know, you should deploy these sensors using chain, shackles, seizing wire, and anchors, the same type of anchors that rock climbers use to keep, you know, these rock climbers use these anchors to save their lives when they fall. And these are systems that are meant to stick into rock. So I think you could make a system for maybe about $80 a piece. These calving sensors are like $1,200 a piece. So I think it's worth spending $75 on a really good rig so you can deploy these sensors. But anyways, they told us just use rope. I used half-inch rope, but it's too much ice. So half of the sensors were gone. And it's because ice had come along we're talking about icebergs that could weigh 100 tons, 200 tons, 1,000 tons, with big, sharp, jagged pieces of ice hanging off of them. And, half-inch line is not going to do too much. And so we got half the sensors, and the other half the sensors were crushed by ice or were ripped apart by ice, or the line was ripped in half by ice. But this is the way that the scientists told us to deploy the sensors, and I imagine in the future we'll be deploying them differently. We'll be using chain because you're not going to chafe through chain. But anyways, it was successful overall. The sensors we did retrieve that weren't destroyed by the ice had a lot of good data on them, and they certainly were counting the calving activity. So we saw accurate counting. We saw the data. We reviewed it. We're not the ones going to make sense of it, but we did review the data, and we did see a lot of activity on it. So that's great. I just think next time we do this, we should use all chain, and I imagine that's what's going to happen. You know, this is still early on in the process of deploying these types of sensors. It was sort of a test trial run to see like how effective they would be. There's very little. Very few people have deployed these in the past for this purpose. So this was sort of the most that anybody has ever done to see if this will work. So I think it'll work. I just think that the rig needs to be a little better. So it was our last hurrah in the ice. There's a lot of heavy ice. There's a lot more ice there than earlier. I think later in the season, these glaciers, it's called moulage. It's or moulange. I think as I say it, and it's like the ice that comes off the glacier. It's small ice mixed with big ice, but there's not a square inch of fresh water showing. It's just brash ice is another way to say it, but it's just ice everywhere. Like you can't see any open water at all anywhere for miles and miles. It is just ice, from anything the size of an ice cube to something the size of this 80-foot boat I'm sitting on. Hell, some of them, the icebergs are the size of office buildings. And it's all this giant jumbled mix of all this ice with absolutely no clean, fresh water, clear water anywhere to be seen, and you just got to push through it. And there wasn't nearly as much of this ice when we deployed the sensors. And now we had a bit of an issue because it's like, well, we got to get back to the site to try to retrieve the sensor, and there's a whole lot more ice in the way than there was earlier. So anyways, I'll talk about that in a minute after the commercial break.
Earliest prehistory reveals mankind's innate connection to the sea. From boats of woven reed in Egypt, to Homer's black ships of the Trojan War, down to the naval battles of Greece, Rome, and every civilization since. I'm Brandon Huebner, and I'll present the history, archaeology, and literature that connect us with our past on the sea, all that on the Maritime History Program. Join me as we voyage down through the ages and witness the development of sailing, trade, and much more. The Maritime History Program, with me, Brandon Huebner, every Wednesday here on Boat Radio.
Hello, it's Matt Rutherford, sitting on a half-sunken ship in West Greenland, getting ready to head across the Labrador Sea. It's our last day here. But anyways, back to the ice in Arrowhead. So we show up and we hike over the island and we retrieve the sensors, you know, I don't know, 3 out of 5 of them or something that were along this island that we had deployed, and we could get there by foot. And the next stage was to get the other glacier or the other pressure sensors that were located much closer to the glacier, and we had to do this by boat and dinghy. And of course, this is a lot riskier because of the potentially giant waves that could kill you, and there's a whole lot more ice. So we show up there, and there's just miles of this melange, this clutter of ice everywhere with no water, and it was really heavy. And you know, we pushed through some pretty heavy stuff earlier up in Kanak. I mean, we had to, because we were going through glaciers, we were dealing with this stuff up there. But at one point it got so thick that I had to put the RPM up considerably, maybe 2000 RPM, just to go 0.7 0.8 knots. I mean, it was like it was really pinching the boat. And I never thought we were going to get stuck in the ice, but, you know, and of course, if I did, I would have worked my way back out and turned around and went the other way, came out the way we came. But I did notice, especially near the big bergs, if you were passing by the berg between the glacier face and the large berg, it's like the large berg was accumulated a heavier mat of this ice. And so pushing, when you pass by one of those, you had to really push the engine a bit just to be able to get through the ice at all and keep any kind of steerage. It was our second to last hurrah. So we picked up the sensors, no giant waves. We were very careful to keep an eye on the glacier face. We're pretty close to the glacier face, so not dangerously close, but close enough that we could see if there was any activity. The next day we tried to leave out of the northern entrance, and I tried to go up there to do some research to deploy some sensors earlier on, and I talked about it in a blog about this like big iceberg trying to run us over, going like 3-4 knots, crept right up on us. We tried to poke through there again. We weren't going to do any research, but it was like a shortcut to get out of there. This place has such strong currents between these islands, and it's the strangest thing. There's these rivers of ice within the current. And, you know, you have a fairly open area of water. And within this area, you know, several miles in all directions. Within this area, you know, there's islands and whatnot. But you have currents that are pretty isolated, maybe only 100 feet or 200 feet wide. And there'll be ice, heavy ice in this entire current. And the ice, there's no like clear water in the ice. There's no areas where you can see water. It's like a very dense cluster of all different types of ice, maybe 200 or 300 feet wide, that's just flowing along at like 2 or 3 knots, maybe even faster in some places. And then on one side or the other, there'll be another section of this heavy, thick ice, again, 100, 200 feet wide, but it's not moving at all. And it's really weird. I mean, it's like some crazy Donkey Kong thing. You're trying to get through this. You know, you're sort of sitting there on the edge of it, and all this ice is flowing by you, and you're trying to wait for like this gap in the ice, and then you shoot through it, and then you got to push your way through the ice on the other side that isn't moving. So we did this for a little while, and I just said to hell with this. I turned around and went back the way we came. It was just way too much current, way too much ice. Mixing current with, you know, strong currents and lots of ice and these like crazy rivers of ice within the water. And it's a really strange thing to see. I mean, you wouldn't think that current would behave in this manner. You would think that the entire body of water would basically have the same current. And sometimes a current's going one way and there's another current going the other way. And so you have ice like passing by each other like cars on a highway, and one lane going one way, one lane going the other way. And there's a bunch of other water around it that isn't affected by the current at all and doesn't have much ice. But then you got these rivers of ice. Really kind of strange. So yeah, I said to hell with that. This is ridiculous. So I turned around and we went back the way we came, and we had to cross through a couple of these, Donkey Kong rivers of ice. But, we got through all right. And then we went back south. We took the long way, which had less ice, and crossed through Disco Bay and came to Assiut. Now, Assiut was where Dana was going to leave. Dana was the mate. And I had somebody else flying in to take his place, a guy from the United States. Dana was from Hungary, although he was educated in Western Europe and spoke a bunch of languages, and was probably more Western European than Eastern European in that regard. But and this guy was a local guy from kind of the Baltimore area. And it was supposed to be the four of us, Alexander, the cameraman, and myself, and Nicole, and leaving here to sail back to the United States. And yesterday, we're about to leave on this crossing. Alexander, the cameraman, just tells me, I'm flying home. I want to fly home. I'm going home. And it's like, I don't know. It really, really pissed me off, to be honest. I mean, I understand him being shaken up. Dana was also really shaken up. I don't think Dana would have sailed back to the United States with us, because he was too shaken up by all that stuff that happened in the storms and everything else. And, he's kind of panicked during the storm and wouldn't help me bring that line on board, and it made the situation a lot worse. And it's just sort of the tendency, and you don't really know how people are going to act. Even people, sailors that have a lot of experience at sea, and until you've really, had to kind of this... until you had to know, oh shit, I might die today. This might, I might die in the next couple hours. Until you've really had to have that thought in your head, you're not going to know how you're going to react or how badly it's going to affect you afterwards. And it broke both of my crew. Now, Nicole, on the other hand, isn't broken at all. I mean, she's got more balls than both of them. But, I guess Nicole is just a brave person. And that's why I sail with her a lot. But I don't know. I would have been less upset about this had he told me 2 weeks ago when he was first thinking about this. But to wait till 24 hours before we're supposed to leave on this crossing to tell me this puts us in a really serious bind, because he's a critical member of the expedition. I mean, we're making these video blogs. I just put another video blog on the website for the research we did in Kanak. You should check it out. It's got a lot of great big ice and icebergs, and it has us pushing through a lot of heavy ice. It'll give you a sense of what I was talking about with this moulage, because that's what that is. That's a lot of this moulage, this heavy jumbled ice. But had he told us then, I would have been able to. I would have been able to fly somebody else in, or another cameraman. I know other camera people that would have came out here. I mean, we have another segment of the expedition we have to document, which is the return home. It's going to be 4 to 6 weeks. It's another 2,500 miles of sailing. And we got to talk about our ocean acidification project, which is a very important project. We've been working on it for almost 3 years now. And ocean acidification is a big deal. And I'll talk about that more later. But So I lose my cameraman. I got no time to fly anybody else in. He's familiar enough with the boat that isn't just losing a cameraman. I'm also losing a member of the crew. I really would rather do this crossing with four people than three. That's the whole reason I flew this other guy out to take Dana's place, is because I would like to have four people on the boat. It's just easier for this, for this sort of thing. And it gives me no time. And on top of that, I had to run all around town, sort of in a panic yesterday, trying to buy a bunch of very expensive camera equipment and audio equipment. Because, of course, when he leaves, he's taking all of his equipment with him, and all I have is one GoPro. If anything good came out of it, I got another microphone. I hope my radio show sounds a little clearer now than it did before, because I have a pretty good microphone I found in... I found there's only one microphone in the entire town, but it was half price. So, yeah, I guess that came out of it. I was in a really big panic because we didn't have money, and there was no cameras in the whole town. And there's a German boat. It's a aluminum-hulled sailboat, maybe, I don't know, 55 feet or something like this, 50 feet, something like this. And good, nice couple, nice German couple, older couple. And I talked to him. I said, hey, man, you know, my cameras, this is the only other sailboat in town. There is a sailboat on the Hard, but it's the only other sailboat in the water. And I sort of told him my story. We're doing this research and blah, 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 blah. My cameraman just bailed on me today, and I'm trying to make these video blogs. And he said, yeah, I have a camera, but I don't have a lens. And it was this really nice Canon camera, which is like a professional camera. And well, my cameraman had the same exact camera, and he had lenses. So I convinced my cameraman to sell me one of his lenses, and the guy says, you know, it's like a $1,500 camera. He's like, you know, but you got to give me 600 euro for the camera. And, you know, if it was a fair price, I mean, there's no doubt about it. It was worth more money than that. And I say, okay, let me check the bank. And I check the bank, and we really don't have the money. And they're like, oh, crap. And the guy motored over and said, you know, I checked out your website. You know, I see that you're legitimate, and I want to donate this to your organization. And it's like, save the day. I didn't have 600 euro to give him. I got like $1,200 right now to get me all the way back to Annapolis, Maryland. 600 euro, that's like $750. I can't afford that. So he saved the day, man. It's, you know, it's people, the kindness of other sailors. It's one of the nice things about the sailing community, too, is that sailors do look out for each other. And, you know, I've had people really look out for me in the past, and I've went out of my way to help other people who needed help. And I think it's a great aspect of our community, is that, you know, we meet each other, especially in these remote places, and, you know, we're willing to help each other. But, you know, Alexander, the cameraman, he let fear grow inside him. I mean, you have to learn, you have to be able to control fear. If you don't control fear, fear will control you. And every one of us, we all have fear in us. Like, I got fear in me. I'm not a fearless person. You know, I had fears in me sailing around the Americas. I got fears in me about crossing the Labrador. I got to cross the Labrador Sea. You know, I'm leaving tomorrow. Labrador Sea is a horribly nasty body of water, and we got to go like 900 miles before we can get the first place we can really stop and get any kind of real shelter. And it's nasty in like the most optimal time of year in the summer. There's a storm in it right now that's blowing 60 knots. And it has, the entire Labrador is a gale outside of that region. It's blowing like 40 and 45. For like 700 miles in like all directions, it's blowing like a nasty gale. I mean, you're talking about major storms that come in. There's nowhere to run and nowhere to hide if one of these systems come in and you're halfway across the Labrador. Like, you're going to get creamed. And it's cold and it's wet and there's snow. I mean, there's nothing nice about the situation. So, I mean, I got fear in me too. You know, I got, you know, a part of me would love to just haul the boat out here in Assiut and fly back home. But I'm not going to do it because I'm not going to let fear, you know, get control. It's important to have fear. You know, but you got to be careful, because what happens is fear can grow roots. And once that fear has grown roots inside of you, it can take over. You know, and fear is infectious. Fear is contagious. You know, you don't want a scared person on your boat. So in that sense, I'm glad that he's leaving, because I don't want somebody on my boat who's going to be afraid, because his fear will be contagious and it could spread to other members of the crew. You know, I want people on the boat to be excited. You know, I'm trying to rally the crew. I'm trying to get them excited about this Labrador crossing. You know, I'm not trying to scare them. I'm trying to say, yeah, this is okay. This is awesome. We got this big challenge ahead of us, but we've been working on the boat for the last, like, I don't know, week and a half here in Assiut. We've been here a little while. I apologize. It's been a while since my last radio show, but it's been kind of crazy. Well, it's just been a lot of work. But Anyways, I feel good about the boat. I feel good about where we are. We don't have any damage. I mean, my wind generators are burned out because they burned out in the storm up north. But my hydro generator is good. I just installed the hydro generator. We got power. I don't know. I feel good about it. You want to get the crew excited. You want them to feel good. You don't want somebody who's scared. You know, but it is disappointing, man, because, you know, it's... I'm losing my cameraman. I'm really lucky that this German couple gave me their camera, and I'm really lucky I was able to find this microphone and I was able to buy the lens. It's really lucky that it's the exact same camera that the cameraman has, because then I could actually buy a lens for it, because you can't buy a lens anywhere here in town. So it's sort of come together. I'm going to try to salvage this video blog. I should be able to still film our journey home, talk about our ocean acidification projects, and have somebody edit it when I get back, and so we can have a final chapter to this expedition. But anyways, we'll be pushing off tomorrow. So you can see blogs on the website, www.oceanresearchproject.org. There are video blogs. You can also find them on YouTube, 2016 Greenland Climate Project. Type that in, search it on YouTube. We can't function without donations. So by all means, they're all tax deductible. Ocean Research Project is a 501c3 nonprofit. And yeah, man, hopefully we get across, hopefully Poseidon lets us cross the Labrador without too much trouble. And I'll try to do a radio show, or at least part of my next show, while I'm out in the middle of the Labrador Sea. So you guys have a good week, and I'll be talking to you later. Bye.
Kuya Nakase, Kuya Nagurok, Kuya Naikilase, Kuya Nasuak!